It won't be easy, but we can do it.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Stuart Lansley, a visiting fellow in the School of Policy Studies at the University of Bristol, a council member of the Progressive Economy Forum, the author of The Richer the Poorer, How Britain Enriched the Few and Failed the Poor, a 200-year history, which was recently published by Bristol University Press, and the author of a new pamphlet for the Fabian Society, The Equality Question, Why Labour Should Re-embrace Its Egalitarian Roots. Welcome to the podcast, Stuart.
Hi, Will, and thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you on, Stuart. Now, the first question that I'd like to ask is, what prompted you to write this pamphlet?
Well, I think that the main reason is that inequality and the great divide that's happened in Britain and that's opened up more heavily in the last 30 or 40 years is thought to be central to the political agenda. But the reality is that it's been more or less marginalised. I mean, politicians do pay lip service to the need to do something about the gaping divide between the top and the bottom. But the truth is that it's been pretty well politically marginalised. And I really wanted to make the case that it should be brought back to the centre stage of British politics. And so what I've tried to do is make the case for that, in part by setting out the consequences of this great surge in inequality and poverty over the last three or four decades, but also to kind of set out a programme about how we might put it back on the political agenda and the kind of strategies and policies that would be needed to close some of the most serious gaps.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And the gaps that, as you address in the first chapter of the pamphlet, are ones that have been occurring and reoccurring in British politics and in the economy for quite a while. In the first chapter, you argue that there have been two fundamentally negative waves of inequality in the past 200 years. The first lasting until the Second World War, 1939, and the second beginning after the end of the Attlee government, with the period during the wartime coalition and then the Attlee administration being a golden period in between, which was responsible for reducing inequality quite significantly. Why do you think that subsequent governments have not seen the pattern that you've described in the pamphlet and better followed the example of the Attlee government?
Well, I mean, as you say, my basic sort of thesis is that if we take the period of the last 200 years, essentially industrial capitalism, Britain has been at the top end of the international inequality and poverty league table for about 80% of this 200-year period. It was only during the post-1904 era when, you know, which was kind of the high point of egalitarianism, that the gap fell. And indeed, the 1970s were a period of peak equality and a low point for poverty. We've never really done better than in the 1970s. I think what happened is that the egalitarians essentially lost the argument. They lost the battle of ideas. And during the crisis of the 1970s, a sort of group that up to that point had been fairly marginalized, but a group of thinkers on the new right had been arguing that egalitarianism had gone too far and that what Britain needed was a very stiff dose of inequality. One of those making that case was Sir Keith Joseph, who was a leading Conservative politician and very close to Mrs. Thatcher. And he, I think, you know, and others persuaded Mrs. Thatcher that what Britain needed was a stiff dose of inequality to get the economy going, and that actually it would increase the size of the cake to such an extent that everybody even if the divisions were greater, would be better off. So it was a kind of doctrinal transformation. It was a sort of counter-revolution against the ideas of equality that had embraced, that had been at the heart of the post-war social democratic experiment. And so what we've effectively had is 4 decades of an inequality experiment. The running the economy at very high levels of inequality, higher levels of poverty, with the aim that this would boost economic enterprise and make everybody better off faster. And of course, now we have the evidence of that experiment. The evidence is very, very clear. It has been a complete failure. None of the theories behind it have proved to be the case. And we've simply had rolling problems, fallout from these much higher levels of division, both sort of bad economics and bad social consequences. So that's, it really is time, I think, that we really had another look at this whole question of equality and inequality and came up with a strategy for taking us back to the egalitarian era.
The second question is related to a quote from the first chapter, in which you argue that levels of inequality and poverty are ultimately the product of the political and economic power games that play out between big business, state, and society. To what extent do you think that the scale of economic change in Britain that is needed to reduce inequality means that big business becomes more influenced by the state? And how do you think that that argument would be made to potentially sceptical voters, those who might think that the state should not interfere or control big business to any great extent?
Well, I think what's happened is that ultimately, the social strength and economic strength of society depends upon achieving a balance between those three big players. That's a sort of big business, the state, and wider society. And wider society includes, of course, the workforce. And what happened in the post-war era is that balance created a sort of steady equilibrium. What happened in the early the counter-revolution of the early 1980s is that balance of power was shifted away from society in favor of big business. The state executed this shift because they thought that by empowering business leaders and weakening state regulation, this would increase the strength of the economy. And what happened was that business leaders took advantage of this new pro-rich, pro-inequality climate, not to build bigger, long and stronger companies and building resilience. What they essentially did is they used this opportunity to grab a larger share of the cake. They devised a number of business methods which were essentially aimed less to do with creating new wealth by building the productive strength of the economy, but by appropriating or extracting the existing wealth of companies. And so what you actually had was a kind of upward shift in the extent to which the rewards from business activity went towards the top, rather than towards wider society. So we had this sort of this development of these pro-inequality forces, partly because of the way the state weakened the system of social protection, but also because business leaders grabbed the license to get rich, which essentially had been awarded to them in the 1980s, in order to exercise a whole series of personal policies of personal enrichment and business self-interest that simultaneously weakened the strength of the economy. So if we actually compare the egalitarian period and the and the post-1980 inegalitarian period, on almost every count of economic performance, it was the first period we did much better. We had higher growth rates, we had higher productivity rates, we had faster rates of social progress. In the latter period, we've essentially created a society which is low wage, low productivity, low growth. And a lot of that is attributable to the change in political economy and the shift in power that has created a much more unbalanced society and unbalanced economy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that the way that you describe that lack of balance is incredibly important, particularly when we're thinking about how inequality is not something that is merely a statistic on a spreadsheet. It is very much a part of people's everyday lives. And in the fourth chapter, you highlight that inequality not only impacts, as I just said, the economic factors in an individual's life, but it's also created a growing trail of social distress. Do you think that the issue of inequality is too often thought of as a purely economic matter and separate from social concerns, and that as such, it means that it hasn't been central to policy arguments in a way that it should be?
Yes, I think that what's happened over the last sort of 30, 40 years is that the rise in inequality has been bad for the economy. But it's also, as you know, you quoted me, you know, it's left this trail of human cost. So it's not just a matter of higher rates of poverty that, you know, are the product essentially of the way in which, the income and wealth have become increasingly concentrated at the top at the expense of the share going to the bottom. Poverty is directly related to that. It's not just a matter of increases in poverty and in increases in, absolute deprivation. Mm. You know, we've seen, we've been going backwards in terms of the living standards at the bottom. People, you know, significant minority of the population are poorer than their parents' generation and the generation before. But it's impacted in other ways. It's impacted in terms of politics. So we know that. So in the mid-1980s, for example, the turnout in general elections between the richest groups and poorest groups was about even. There wasn't really a gap. Today, we have something a 22% gap. So essentially, we've been disenfranchising a section of the population who've effectively given up on their hope that politicians would actually look after their interests. It's also been driving this great surge in inequality is also a key factor in driving climate change, because the rich are the biggest promoters of the climate crisis and pollution. And that's what happens when you get economies that are distorted towards the top. What you get is a form of luxury capitalism in which resources are essentially transferred from meeting basic needs to meeting these sort of high levels of excess and luxurious spending. So, and we know that, you know, the private yacht, the private jet, for example, are among the biggest sources of global pollution. I think we've lost sight of this. I think, you know, that politicians have kind of ignored these links, this link between the concentration of wealth and the wider consequences, which have weakened our economic performance, but also had these significant social consequences. And unless we really start tackling this problem, these issues are going to intensify and get worse over the next couple of decades. So I think we are at a tipping point now that I think, the present levels of inequality almost certainly unsustainable. And therefore, I think it's gradually going to force its way back onto the political agenda.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, I mean, you mentioned the lack of engagement there for those who were obviously towards the bottom end of the economic spectrum, those who have suffered the most from the inequality gap. Do you think that really can be seen as one of the driving forces behind populist movements that we've seen both in the UK and the US, and that really by tackling inequality and reducing inequality, you also at the same time stop those populist, often very far right movements from gaining ground?
Well, I mean, I think that we've had different sorts of social movements. Mm-hmm. We've had progressive social movements over the last few decades, the women's movement, the anti-racist movement, the environmental movement, that have attempted to build the case for a more progressive society. But I think but we've also seen over the last decade or a little bit longer the negative kind of movements that have been moving up. And I think unless we tackle this level of injustice and so on, then large groups of the world's population are going to turn to more extreme politics because they will begin to feel that liberal democracies have kind of failed them. They failed to look after their interests. So, and I think we can see the sort of move towards right wing parties in certain Western countries, including the United States and so on, can be not totally attributed to the failure of the mainstream political classes to tackle this question of distribution, to make sure that the proceeds of economic activity are more equally and fairly shared.
Mm-hmm. And in regards to the political establishment, in Chapter 6, you make the argument that New Labour made steps, positive steps, towards reducing inequality, in particular inequality in real terms and childhood inequality, but it fell short of its own aims for a reduction of inequality. How far do you think that the reduction of inequality as an aim fell victim to the need to present the Labour Party under Tony Blair, New Labour, as being as much a party for the well-off as it was for those in need of help?
Well, I think New Labour bought in to the argument that the pro-market argument, and they basically thought that the role of they essentially abandoned Labour's commitment to egalitarianism. They felt it was possible to tackle poverty without worrying about what was happening at the top of the distribution. They effectively abandoned the pro-equality goal of Labour, but they did set very significant targets to try and reduce poverty. And they, to some extent, they succeeded, but the strategy was never sustainable. As long as the level of poverty is ultimately the product of how the cake is shared, and if you allow the cake to go on being, colonized, gains from economic activity colonized by the top, then you're always going to have downward pressure on wages, incomes, and living standards at the bottom. And so I think Labour was, trying to fight poverty with one hand behind its back. And we now know that inequality rose under New Labour while poverty fell a little bit. But that proved unsustainable. The last 15 years have reversed the gains that were made under Labour, in large part because of their failure to tackle inequality and make inequality a key part of their economic and social goals.
Mm-hmm. We've discussed the Labour Party and New Labour in in that section with regard to that question. But I'd like to now turn to the Conservative Party. To what extent do you think that the aims of so-called compassionate conservatives can be seen in some way as a smokescreen? That the advocacy for reducing inequality is used as a tool to ensure continued support of the party from those British people who are less well off?
I think, well, I mean, what we know is that during the 1990s and during the sort of long period of New Labour dominance, the Conservatives did try to reinvent themselves. Mm. And so you had compassionate conservatism and leading conservatives saying, you know, they wanted to tackle poverty and inequality. And I think there's no doubt that part of that was to try and change their appeal, to try and appeal to a wider section of the electorate, because they'd had a long period in the wilderness, and they wanted to get back in power. And what happened, in you know, from 2010 onwards, that a lot of these promises essentially evaporated. I mean, again, they kind of played lip service. I mean, both David Cameron and Theresa May talked about social injustice and in big policy statements, but they effectively, this was kind of double speak. I mean, they were effectively carrying out strategies of austerity, cutting benefit levels, demonizing those claimants, imposing, you know, sanctions on claimants, and so on. While allowing the rich to get richer. So I think that that what we've had is this sort of politics of division, kind of hidden by kind of language, softer language, that gives the pretense. And I think, you know, we've had the levelling up agenda in the last, you know, the Boris Johnson's levelling up agenda, which to some extent was a recognition that Britain had allowed divisions to get too deep-seated. But we know that this, again, was pretty token. There was very few resources were devoted to it. It probably wasn't going to make very much different. And now it's effectively being abandoned.
The finally, the current, as of the time of recording, Prime Minister has made much of an argument that something has to be done to achieve growth in the economy, that, as she argued, by cutting taxes for the wealthiest, they will invest more in Britain, and that money will eventually trickle down to those less well off. That, to use her phrase, or a version of her phrase, the pie will grow bigger. What are your thoughts on the motivation behind the Prime Minister's economic policy, and why it has so utterly failed?
Well, I mean, what's happened over the last, you know, 4 or 5 weeks essentially is a restatement of the doctrines of the new right of the 1970s, that high levels of inequality are the way to promote growth and high levels of productivity. When we've had 40 years of an attempt to apply that doctrine, and we know that it is largely failed. It's a completely false doctrine. Increasing levels of inequality does not lead to stronger and more resilient economies and faster rates of growth. Indeed, they've created the opposite. So it is a completely false doctrine. The interesting thing is, I think that what's happened is that this sort of attempt to try and return to that pro-inequality philosophy as a political, as a way of running society, has clearly reached its limit. Mm. Because what's happened is that you've had a rebellion by large sections of the Conservative Party who basically say you can't, you know, have a political philosophy that in a period of deep crisis, when you've had stagnant wages and falling living standards and rising levels of homelessness, you simply cannot, you can't abandon the groups who are suffering the consequences of past policies and simultaneously allow the rich to get richer. So her whole philosophy has been shown to be unsustainable and untenable. And now, of course, the Conservative Party are kind of rowing back. But they're rowing back in a way that is still going to leave giant gaps. When you know what we now know is that the collapse of the economic problems of the last decade are driven in large part by the austerity economics of post 2010 are about to be replayed. Now looks as though that they've restored some of the tax cuts, but left a sizable hole in the deficit, which is going to be filled by another round of austerity, which is the opposite of what you need if you're going to create growth. If you're going to create growth, the last thing you should be doing is cutting levels of public investment and cutting wages, public sector wages, which is just going to intensify the recession that was coming in any case. So I think, what we've got at the moment is a sort of package of policies and philosophy that is going to intensify the economic and social problems that have arisen over the last two decades.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you very much for your time, Stuart, and your contribution to the podcast. I would highly recommend that anybody who hasn't got themselves a copy of the Equality Question make sure that they do. It's a fascinating dissection of some of the mistakes that we have made in policy relating to inequality and offers examples of how we can fix those problems. If people want to find out more about your work and more about the things that you were doing, where should they go online to find out more about your work and more about you?
Well, I do have a website, which is www.stuartlansley.co.uk. So it should be fairly easy to find. And then, I haven't really kept it up to date, but quite a lot of my recent work is there, if anybody's interested in following up.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure that there will be. And thank you once again for taking part in the podcast.
Well, thanks, Will. That was very interesting. Thanks for inviting me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.